Welcome to Hard Talk from the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today is Canada's Minister of Defence, Bill Blair. Canada, a founder member of NATO, has consistently failed to meet NATO's agreed target of at least 2% of national GDP to be spent on defence. Now that infuriated Donald Trump when he was in the White House, and it's become more difficult to defend since Russia's all-out invasion of Ukraine raised geopolitical tensions to new highs. Canada, of course, is a long way from Kyiv and has the comfort of having the world's greatest military power as its southern neighbour and partner. Nonetheless, there are signs that the Canadian public is increasingly uneasy with the country's lack of modern military capacity. So is this vast, prosperous country ready to get serious about defending itself? Well, Bill Blair joins me now on the line from Ottawa. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. As Minister of Defence in Canada, how embarrassed are you that your country is still significantly failing to spend at least 2% of your GDP on defence?
Stephen, I'm not embarrassed at all, because Canada, under our government, has been investing very significantly in defense, and there's been a very strong upward trajectory of defense spending. We've just introduced our latest defense policy, which injects a significant amount of new investment into defense spending. It builds up greater capabilities. It moves us much closer to the target of 2%. And with some of the other things that we've articulated in this defense policy, I think we are on a strong and inevitable path to achieving that 2% goal. Canada is well aware of its responsibilities to our NATO allies, to our continental allies through NORAD in the United States and even around the world. And as well, we are very strongly focused, as you've just mentioned, on our responsibilities to defend our own country and our own sovereignty. And we're making very significant new investments. We'll be at 1.76 as a result of this year's budget. And we have also sent a very clear signal to our allies. We know we have to do more. We're going to do more. We're investing in additional capabilities that will put us on a very clear and strong path to 2%.
Minister, you dress it up as best you can, but you're basically breaking a very clear promise. Your Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, was one of the NATO leaders who last year fully committed to meet that 2% target. You've just told me you're going to get to 1.76% of GDP on defence, but that won't be until the financial year 29-30. So not only are you breaking your promise, you're not even going to get close to meeting your promise after the next 5 years.
And Stephen, if I may be clear, I think we can demonstrate to our allies that we're working hard to actually keep that promise. And in fact, my defense spending budget is going to increase by 27% next year over this year. And since 2017, our government began investing significantly in defense. We have more than doubled our defense spending in that ensuing 7 years. But as a result of the new investments we're making, we're in fact tripling our defense spending, and we still have more to do.
If I may say so, Minister, that simply shows how little you've spent on defense over many, many years. The opposition Conservatives say that Canada's military is simply disfigured by dwindling personnel numbers, rusting warships, deteriorating fighter jets. And one of your experts in the country on defense studies, Paul Mitchell, says that your government's approach remains lackadaisical and feckless. That nobody is convinced by what you've told me.
Those are remarkable statements coming from, for example, the Conservatives, who, when they were in government, actually reached a historic low in defense spending of less than 1% of GDP. Their abysmal record of support for national defense and defense capability, I think, speaks for itself. Indeed speak. And in fact, as I've just said, we've already undertaken initiatives to double our defense spending. We're now working towards tripling our defense spending. And in every single case, the Conservatives have voted against those initiatives. So quite honestly, Stephen, their words don't match their deeds. The criticism that the critics level, there's always old generals who talk about what we have not done. But quite frankly, I look at their awful record in making sure that the Canadian Armed Forces were ready, the lack of preparation that we inherited from the previous government, the investments that we are making and the work that we're doing now. For example, we're replacing our Halifax class frigates. They have been on the water for 45 years. They actually cost more to maintain than to replace. We're also investing in new fighter aircraft. We're investing in new capabilities for our Army. We have more work to do in acquiring underwater surveillance and integrated air and missile defense. All of those expenditures are going to take us well past 2%.
Thing is,
frankly, it would be very nice if some of those feckless critics could be a little bit clearer in showing support for those investments. They talk a good game, but they never deliver.
Polls suggest that many Canadians are increasingly concerned about the lack of military capacity in your country, given the geopolitical situation that we see, rising tensions around the world. I just wonder how you, as Minister of Defence, can be satisfied with such vague commitments to future military capabilities. For example, this phrase in your most recent defense review that you've just been talking about with me, that Canada is, quote, exploring options for renewing and expanding its submarine fleet. Now, this is a key strategic asset, and you can't be more vague than simply saying we're looking at options.
Stephen, one of the things I will not put in our defense policy is unfunded commitments. And so the money that our government committed to defense spending in this latest budget, which we now have before the House, but which only introduced in April by our finance minister, that the money that we've committed to that is going to significantly advance it. But I would point out, Stephen, we've been very clear. We know we have to invest in underwater surveillance. We have to replace. We have an aging Victoria-class fleet that, frankly, we bought them secondhand from the UK in the 90s. Those ships are no longer fit for purpose. We need to replace them. I'm doing the work now to identify exactly what our requirements are and to go into the marketplace and send a clear signal to those that we require this capability. And when that work is done, and it will not take that long, I'll be able to go back to my government and secure the funding that will be necessary to do it. But Stephen, you mentioned the Canadians' growing concern. That quite frankly has been very purposeful for me. I was named the defense minister about 9 months ago. And what I found at the time that there was not a great deal of support among Canadians for significant new investments in defense. You know, there are natural and understandable concerns about affordability and housing issues, health care and dental care, and support for seniors, and lifting kids out of poverty. All of those things are important obligations for our government. But I began very purposely having conversations with Canadians about the need to invest more in defense. And what we have seen over the past 8 months is a near doubling in support among Canadians for the investments that we know we have to make in defense. And I think one of the things that was most compelling for Canadians was a refocusing of our defense policy on our responsibilities to defend Canada, to defend our north, to defend the Arctic approaches, because of the changing geopolitical situation and the actions of Russia and China in around the world, but in particularly in our Arctic.
Right.
Climate change.
I want to get to specifics like your Arctic strategy in just a second, but just to stick with the big picture, the Achilles heel of Canada for a very long time has been your reliance on the United States and the assumption that you'll always be protected by your big neighbor and partner to the south. You can't be so complacent anymore, can you? And the Americans are putting real pressure on you now. We had a senior American general saying that he's going to have tough conversations with Canada. And we heard Donald Trump, when he was president, mocking Justin Trudeau for the failure of your government to spend enough on defense. The Americans will force you to get real, won't they?
Well, Stephen, I think you're kind of ignoring Canada's long history of being there for our allies. Canada was the first to answer Britain's call in the Second and in the First World War. Most of the investments of the Canadian Armed Forces have not been domestic, as you say, because we have the benefit of geography. We are surrounded by three oceans, one of which has mostly been frozen, at least in the past, and we have a benign neighbor and a supportive superpower in the United States. But Canada's military has been active and engaged in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific and in the Middle East and around the world.
Yeah, well, Canada's given less military and financial assistance to Ukraine than small European countries, relatively small countries like Denmark and Norway. How do you justify that?
I would just simply point out, I think you might want to go back and check the math, simply because Canada's investment in Ukraine since the onset of the war, first of all, we didn't begin in 2022 when Russia invaded Ukraine the latest time. But in 2015, we began training the Ukrainian armed forces in Ukraine. And in 2022, after that invasion, we had to move some of that training out of Ukraine into Poland and at Camp Lid in the UK. But we've continued to make those investments. But Canada has actually contributed nearly $14 billion in both military and other financial aids to Ukraine since the onset of hostilities. We work very closely with President Zelensky. I work very closely in partnership. I've spoken to him a couple of times this week with Minister Umerov and their defense industry minister as well, that there are really strong ties between our two countries. We have, from the very outset of hostilities and even well before hostilities, been there for Ukraine and will continue
to
be there
for Ukraine. Well, you say you've been there for Ukraine. I know that you've spoken to the Ukrainians many times, as indeed has Justin Trudeau. But I look at the message you send and compare it with that coming, for example, in recent weeks from President Macron in France, who has said that it is time to stop talking of red lines. He won't even rule out the possibility of sending French and Western troops into Ukraine, into the theater of war. You, on the other hand, have always very explicitly said, and I'm quoting something you said in the past, I do not want to put Canadian armed forces anywhere near that combat theater.
Listen, I was at that meeting with President Macron. I think it was an important conversation for all the European and NATO leaders who were at that table, and I was president as well. We're all looking for ways in which we can step up and assist Ukraine more. But at the same time, I think you will note that my position is very closely aligned with your government's position with respect to the supports that we are providing to Ukraine. And at the same time, we've also understand the caution that many of our European and NATO allies have with respect to the deployment of troops in the country. We're very respectful of those concerns. And as well, we work very closely with Ukraine. What I have also said is that I'm quite open to deploying troops in Ukraine at the right time. But in consultation with our NATO allies, this is not the time, and there are other ways in which we can continue to support Ukraine.
You talked about the Arctic a moment ago. Let's talk specifically about the far north. Do you see Russia and China as hostile actors now in the Arctic north? And what are you doing, if that is the case, to combat the threat you see?
For Canada, Arctic sovereignty and Arctic security isn't merely having a plane fly by periodically or even a boat sail by or a ship sail by when the ice is out. It really is about investing in a persistent presence for our military, but also strength and infrastructure for the people that live in our north. That's how we maintain our sovereignty. What we have seen, some far more aggressive action of our adversaries in the north. We certainly have seen this and witnessed it for some period of time, but increasingly from Russia as well. And also, we're starting to see far more interventions from the People's Republic of China in the Arctic as well. And I think part of it is the Arctic is also, I think, an opportunity, but an important source of security on our supply chains for the free world. And so we see that those could potentially be challenged by our adversaries, and we have a responsibility to our allies and to our own country to be there more persistently, to be stronger, and to put the infrastructure in place, the capability and the people that are going to enable us to maintain our security. And by the way, Stephen, you spoke a little bit about the work that we do with the Americans. Canada recently committed nearly $40 billion to NATO modernization, and that's going to include installations in Canada by Canadians, spending Canadian dollars on Arctic over the horizon and polar over the horizon, installations on Arctic satellite receiving stations, new northern support hubs where we will be able to deploy our new fighter jets, our transport planes, our AWACS surveillance fleet, and even our tactical helicopters.
Just to be clear about one thing, significantly
in being there for our allies in the north.
Right. Sorry to interrupt, Minister, but just to be clear about one thing, we've talked about the showdown between NATO, Western powers, and Russia in Ukraine, with all of the Western assistance going to Ukraine. In the past, there's always been an attempt to keep the Arctic separate from other geopolitical tensions. Indeed, there is this Arctic Council, which Russia plays a full part in, where the effort is to get all the Arctic countries to talk to each other, to get a dialogue going, which is insulated from wider geopolitical tensions. Is that era over? Is the Arctic Council effectively dead now?
Stephen, it's an excellent question. I think with the advent of Finland and Sweden into NATO, There is a responsibility. I've been meeting this week with the Nordic ambassadors to Canada, but also with my colleagues and, who are defense ministers from those countries. And so for Finland, Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Denmark, the United States and us, and as well, and I think that the United Kingdom has an interest here as well, we recognize that we have a responsibility in the protection of NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization has a northern frontier, and that is the Arctic. And I agree, we do not want to see that become a theater of conflict. And there are a number of important diplomatic efforts, including the Arctic Council, but quite frankly, that relationship has been badly shaken, I think, by Russia's activity and aggressive actions, the illegal invasion of Ukraine. And it is cause for deep concern among the allies. We understand that in order to actually keep the peace in the Arctic, we have to be strong in the Arctic. It's one of the reasons I've turned our national defense policy strongly towards that responsibility, and we're going to work very closely in collaboration, obviously for the continental defense with the United States, but for the Arctic defense with all of our NATO allies. And I think it's a shared responsibility, and when we are collaborative and we work together, I think we can be strong and we can deter that ever becoming a theater of conflict.
Briefly, if you can, does Canada want to join the so-called AUKUS group? That is Australia, the UK, alongside the United States in a special security arrangement. Now, its short-term goal is to achieve cooperation on submarine technology, the idea to give Australia access to that submarine technology, but in a more wide sense, it's information sharing on technology, AI, new weapon systems. Does Canada want to join, and how quickly?
And very clearly, the first pillar of AUKUS was really about sharing of nuclear technology for nuclear submarines. And Canada, quite frankly, is in the market for conventionally powered submarines. That's what our Navy requires to do the work that we do. Our Five Eyes partners, Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, are our closest allies, and we work very closely to get them together. We've had discussions with them. I have every expectation that we will have an opportunity to work on the second pillar of AUKUS. And as you mentioned, that includes, well, I think Canada's got very significant contributions to make in AI and quantum computing that would be mutually beneficial to the AUKUS, the original AUKUS partners. I think we can make a contribution. And I know there are a number of other countries on a case-by-case, project-by-project basis that can make a real contribution to the second pillar of AUKUS. Canada certainly is quite anxious and
have
willing
you,
to be
yeah,
part,
well, okay,
part
so
of
your
that.
Your ambition initiative. Is clear. Have you considered the fact that if Donald Trump wins the White House in November, Donald Trump may well not want Canada in AUKUS? He's described Justin Trudeau variously as dishonest, weak, a far-left lunatic. It's pretty unlikely Trump's going to want to cozy up to Canada under Justin Trudeau.
With respect, I've worked with the United States for very many years, for decades, on a number of different fronts, on the public safety side and now on the defense side. There's more to America than the White House. And our relationship with the U.S. military, our relationship with their Congress, and with Americans, I think, is the strength and the basis of our continental security. We're going to continue to work hard on that, and we are making the investments in NORAD modernization and in our own military to be good partners to the United States, and I'm very confident that our allies in the Five Eyes know that Canada has much to contribute, and I'm very confident that we'll
all right.
Be able
well,
to-
let's talk about the Middle East. Let's talk about Israel and what it may be about to do in Gaza, in particular, mounting an all-out assault on Rafah, where roughly 1.3 million displaced Palestinians are currently living. Joe Biden has said in the last 24 hours, if they, the Israelis, go into Rafah, we are not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells that have been used by the Israelis. Is Canada saying the same thing? I'm a little confused about your defense relationship with Israel. Have you already halted all arms supplies or not?
Yes, we have not been supplying arms to Israel throughout any portion of this conflict. We do have a trade relationship with them, but it does not include the provision of armaments to Israel. That we have a very rigorous export regime and no permits have been issued since this conflict began. Let me also say, though, that Canada shares President Biden's concern about a conflict in Rafah because of the vulnerability of a significant civilian population. And we have called for a ceasefire. We called for the return of those hostages and greater access of humanitarian aid into the region. And we are deeply concerned about the impact on innocent civilians. And we share that with our allies in the United Kingdom and in the United States. And we will continue to work towards a peaceful resolution of that conflict.
To be clear, though, your relationship with Israel clearly has been damaged by what the Israelis have done in Gaza. in recent weeks and months. You're saying that right now Canada is no longer prepared to supply arms to Israel, right?
What I have said is, frankly, we strongly support Israel's right to exist and to defend itself.
It's not the question
and
I asked
we
you.
We strongly condemn the Hamas attack that occurred. I know, but I think it's an important context, Stephen. We strongly condemn the Hamas attack, but at the same time, we have every expectation that in Israel's efforts to defend itself, they will respect international law and that they will always do everything possible to protect innocent civilians. We have expressed to them our strong concern and condemnation of the humanitarian crisis that has been created in Gaza, and particularly we are very worried about continued or expanded hostilities in Rafah because there's a very vulnerable population
right.
in there.
Before we end, for their safety. I do want to get to one other arena, and that is your relationship with China. A judge who launched a commission of inquiry into foreign interference in Canadian affairs, particularly politics, concluded that China has been the most persistent and sophisticated foreign interference threat to Canada, and the government must re-establish trust by informing the public of what has been going on and taking real concrete steps to deter and counter it. Can you convince the Canadian public that you are capable of counteracting Chinese cyber threats?
Yeah, first of all, I agree completely with the judge that we have a responsibility to make sure Canadians are aware of the threat that the People's Republic of China represents. Two very important critical infrastructure and public institutions in Canada, they have made a very concerted effort to interfere with our society and with our elections. I would also point out, I was public safety minister prior to being the defense minister. I issued a very public document to Canadians in 2020, alerting them to the threat of Chinese political interference.
One of the allegations was that you and indeed the prime minister were not really across the nature of the threat. You didn't even read some of the papers that your own intelligence service provided about what the Chinese were doing.
And unfortunately, you're misinformed on that one, Stephen, because in fact, the testimony before the inquiry was that our intelligence services did not supply that information and it did not share that with the government at the time. But we have taken very concerted efforts to respond to that. As a matter of fact, we've just introduced legislation to introduce a foreign agent registry in Canada in direct response to the activities of not just China, but there are other countries also hostile to our country and to our interests. Also, one of the things I'm responsible for is the communication security establishment. We've just invested very significantly in the creation of a new cyber force. We are doing what is necessary to protect ourselves against those types of attacks.
Right. Just to end on the thought I aired earlier, Canadians in the past might have thought they were pretty flame-proof. I guess the message today is Canada is not as fireproof as you and other Canadians might have hoped.
Yeah, well, you know, for 150 years, Canada has stepped up to fight alongside our allies to defend world peace and an international rules order that has kept us all safe. We recognize that our country is now, because of the changing climate, the changing technologies, and the activities of some of our potential adversaries, we are also now closer to the front line. Canada shares the largest maritime border with Russia of any country in the world. I recognize we have responsibilities to defend our country,
right.
our continent, and to be there strong for our allies. But I think if you're going to be strong around the world, you have to be strong at home.
Bill Blair, I thank you for joining me on Hard Talk. Thanks.
My pleasure, Stephen. Thanks for having me.